Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome back to our Breakfast in the Base series. And this morning we were speaking about the Torah life and thought of the Satmar Rebbe, Rav Yoel Teitelbaum. It's a little nerve-wracking to be speaking in front of a Satmar Chassid, but God willing, we'll try to do a decent job in giving over the story of the Satmar Rebbe. There are a few different biographies. I use this one over here, written by Rabbi Chaya Moshe Stauber. He was a self-proclaimed Talmud, and I assume a real Talmud of the Satmar Rebbe. There may be some inconsistencies, perhaps, as some Satmar Chassidim seem to say, about the text. Ultimately, it is a great biography, and I highly recommend it if you want to know more about the Satmar Rebbe. So let's begin.
Can we interrupt? Parallel to this book, there are two books in English on the Satmar Rebbe. He was the Satmar Chassid. The other one, I don't know if you saw Meisel's book.
Yeah.
Meisel's was a vision of the Chassid who wrote about Satmar. I'm just going to fill in your...
Yeah. Whenever I don't know something, you just turn to Dr. David. Okay, so the one important point to begin with is that the Satmar Rebbe is probably one of the most unknown figures in our world. And when I say our world, I'll broadly define that as like modern orthodoxy. And the reason why is because there were some beliefs of his that were sort of not in line with how we normally view Judaism. In particular, his view on Zionism in Israel was very different from what most of us believe. But nonetheless, as my Rabbi Mordechai Willig always used to say, that the Satmar Rebbe was a Gaon Olam, that he was a tremendous Rav and Talmud Chacham, and the stuff that we didn't necessarily agree with, that was like side stuff. The Israel stuff was not his primary thing. It sort of just became what he was known for because of the fact that it was so not appreciated in our community. Okay, so the Satmar Rebbe, though, ultimately left a tremendous impact on the world, and we will hopefully begin to see a little bit about the impact that he made. So he was born on the 18th of Teves in the year 5647, in 1887, January 13th, 1887, in Siget, where his father was the rabbi. The Satmar Rebbe of Yoel Teitelbaum was the founder and the first Rebbe of the Satmar dynasty, as we'll see. The reason why is because he moved to a town called Satmar, and that's sort of where it all came from. He was known as being somewhat of an isolationist, and when I say that, what I mean is that he was someone who did not really want to be heavily immersed in the world. I mean, in the Hasidus in general, you're sort of more separate than the rest of the world so that you can work on your own personal growth and you can work on the communal growth. As we mentioned just a moment ago, he was not super Zionist, and probably the nice way to put it is that he was anti-Zionist. But he came from a very long list of rabbis. Rabbi Moshe Teitelbaum was the great-great-grandfather of Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, known as the Yismach Moshe. That was a sefer that he had published. Interestingly, even though the Satmar Rebbe was obviously a Chassid, and he came from a line of Chassidim, his great-great-grandfather was not a Chassid, he was like a big Litvak, but as the story goes, he was like converted, as it were, by the Choza of Lublin, by the Seer of Lublin, who he was so impressed with some of the miracles and other things that he claimed to do, and that he did evidently before his eyes, that he became a big Chassid, and then the rest of the family obviously turned towards Chassidus. What's interesting, though, is that probably because the family wasn't they were not always Chassidim, they did not have a lot of the classic characteristics of Chassidus. And when I say that, I mean, as sometimes people, when they talk about Chassidus, they do so disparagingly, in that they, think of the Chassidim as like dancing and singing, but they don't think of them as like serious Talmidei Chachamim and serious Torah learners. But Satmar was known for their tremendous Torah learning, although they were involved in, and they still are involved in, all the tremendous things that Chassidim are known for as well. They are additionally known for their tremendous Torah knowledge. And so that is clearly going back to the fact that the family was not always involved in Chassidus. His father, Rav Yoel's father, was Rabbi Hananiah Yom Tov Lipa Teitelbaum, otherwise known as the Kedushas Yom Tov, again named after a sefer that he had written. He was a Rav in a community. He struggled to have kids with his first wife. He then ultimately married a second wife, and that was Rabbi Yoel's mother. Very famously, he had said about his son that Rabbi Yoelish was never really a child, that the Rebbe was essentially a Rebbe from birth, that he was descended from such a great line of individuals, and he was clearly the next link in that chain. One second, sorry. Just to share a quick story, you take a look at source number one. So just you should know your packets start on page five. So we're on page five. And I apologize, it's not super clear, but I think we'll be able to get through it. So the story goes, take a look from like that fancy letter over there in the middle of the page. So he was born on 18th Tevis 5647, a second son to older parents who longed to have more children. Even as a child, Yoel was recognized as a rare prodigy. He was very bright and studious and always learning Torah. When most of their children were still playing and enjoying themselves, Yoel was immersed in Torah from early morning until late at night. Young Yoelish was a wonder child, recognized for his wit, wisdom, and charm at a very young age. When he was 5 years old, his father, the Kedushas Yom Tov, asked him to sing Eishes Chayah at the Tish on Leil Shabbos. Decades later, elderly Hasidim remembered that magical moment, okay, etc., etc. From next paragraph, from then on, Yoelish's Eishes Chayah was an intrinsic part of the Leil Shabbos Tish. Nonetheless, he was still a child, and when the Tish lasted many hours, the young boy grew tired, and sometimes even put his head down to rest. Once on a late summer night, as his father, the Kedushas Yom Tov, began reciting Torah thoughts, Yoelish, who was seated next to him on his left side at the head of the table, seemed to have dozed off. The moment the Divrei Torah were finished, Yoel sat up and straightened entirely, rubbed his eyes. One of the older Hasidim sitting in the front loved to, so knew, he said in a loud, booming voice, "How do you know when your father is finished, so that you wake up exactly when he's done?" So Yoelish was hurt by the comment. "If you will shtel a bottle of wine in front of us, I will repeat all the Divrei Torah." Right? So Yoelish basically said, he was a little boy at this point, he said, "Put a bottle of wine in front of me." Hopefully he didn't drink it, but other people around him, I guess, were drinking it. And he said, "You guys drink the wine, and I'll tell over the Torah." And then it's hard to read, so I'll just say the rest outside. But basically, he went on to quote word for word all the words of Torah that his father had shared. And again, somehow amazingly, he knew all the words of Torah, even though he seemingly fell asleep during his talk. But just to speak to the great Torah knowledge and Torah's scion that he would become, we see that in this story right over here. The Rebbe was known for his lack of sleep, as many great Gedolim were known for. He slept very little, and he learned a lot even from a very young age. They say that once he turned bar mitzvah, he became more of an ascetic. He really had removed himself from most worldly matters. It's actually interesting, because when the Rebbe got a little bit older, I think towards like his later years in life, he would lament that he did not take better care of himself, because, you know, he lived, thank God, to a ripe old age, but still he had felt that if he would have taken care a little bit better care of himself, perhaps he would have been able to do and accomplish more. So we did share that regret on a few moments, just about making sure that he could have done more to care for his health. That ultimately we know, of course, you said throughout the pandemic, v'nishmartem me'odes nashoseichem, we have to take care and protect our lives and our bodies, and so perhaps that was his way of saying that he could have done a little bit of a better job at doing that. One of the stories that sort of alludes to the incredible kindness that this young little man had sort of intrinsically within him was that there's a story that's told that when he was a little boy, his mother bought him a fur coat just to be able to survive the harsh winters there. And at one point, the mother noticed that her son was going out and he didn't have that fur coat anymore. And she said, "Where'd your coat go?" And he basically said, "Well, there was a boy in my class that I noticed needed it a lot more than I do. He was very cold, so he gave him his fur coat." And so the little Yoelish decided that he was going to freeze throughout the winter, and he would be able to give his coat to this other boy so that he wouldn't freeze. His mother was very upset by this, but nonetheless, she was obviously impressed by this young little tzaddik that she was raising. By the age of 17 in the year 1904, so he got married. This would be his first wife and the only wife that he would have children with. He married a girl named Chava. She was the daughter of Rabbi Avram Chaim Horowitz, known as the Plancher Rav. So the wedding was actually moved up earlier than it was originally anticipated to be, because his father, the Kedushas Yom Tov, was very sick and almost on his, essentially on his deathbed. In fact, they moved the wedding to be, I think, in the house so that his father could be the Masadar Kedushin. Unfortunately, he ended up passing away 11 days after the wedding. At the conclusion of the Shloshim, so I guess 41 days after the wedding had actually taken place, the newly married couple went to Poland to move in with her family. And they would ultimately have three daughters together, and the Samarav would only have these three children. Unfortunately, he outlived all all of them because of the fact that his first wife unfortunately had a terrible heart condition, and she had unfortunately passed that on to their three kids as well, and so they all had relatively short lives. The first daughter was Chaya Reza, and she actually lived the longest out of all of them. She would pass away in 1953, but then they had two other daughters, Esther, who died in the year 1921, and then Rachel, who died in 1931, who was married and had passed away shortly after her wedding. None of his daughters were able to have children, and so unfortunately there is no biological son or child to sort of that was able to bring on his legacy, and that ultimately led to some exciting stuff that happened in Samar after his passing, which we'll get to towards the end. In the year 1905, about 1.5 years after their marriage, they finally moved to a town called Satmar. In this town, there was a Rav in the town, but he, the Satmar Rebbe, well, before he was the Satmar Rebbe, Rabbi Yoelish, he was asked to lead like a little base medrash there, so he did that. He sort of began building up a following, but of course, at the end of the day, since there was a Rav of the town, who they had a seemingly a good relationship, but there was a Rav of the town, so he did not want to be there for much longer, and so he would, from Satmar, move to another town called Orshava. I don't know if that's pronounced correctly, or Shiva. They're the Hasidic ideas that they bring down, or Shiva, the light of seven, what that means, but the town was Or Shiva. So in the year 1911, he would move there. He would ultimately move back, I think, in the mid-1930s, back to the town of Samar after a whole bunch of back and forth, and that's when he became the Samar Rebbe, but until then, he was just a Rebbe Yoel. So he moved to be in this town in 1911. In 1914, just a few years after, his mother passed away, and of course, in 1914, in the summer, that was the beginning of World War I. What's interesting is that because of the fact that the Rabbi Yoel was a Hungarian citizen living in Orshava, which is in Czechoslovakia, so he decided to go back to the city of Satmar. So that I don't fully know the history over here. I guess Sam maybe will fill it in for me. But it wasn't good for him to be in this town of Orshava because he could have been something bad could have happened to him. So he went back to the town of Satmar for a period of time. But ultimately, in 1922. He would make his way back to the town of Orshava, where he would stay there and remain the Rebbe of the town for a number of years. He would accomplish incredible things there. He built a yeshiva there. He built up tremendous religious growth in the community. And then ultimately in 1926... he was offered a position in Czechoslovakia, in the town of Krul, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but in Czechoslovakia that had a very large and diverse population. And there as well, he established a yeshiva, and he brought Torah life there, and it was all sort of, in retrospect, the stepping stones to what was to come very soon. In 1931... his second daughter, Rachel, passed away. Esther had passed away right before they moved back to Orshava in 1922. So now his second daughter had passed away in 1931. She was just recently married, and of course they didn't have any children because she was so recently married. And so now he was left with only his first wife and his oldest daughter. In 1934, at the age of 47, the Rabbi Yoel moved back to the town of Satmar to become the rabbi of the community. There was a lot of back and forth. Should he be the rabbi? Should he not be the rabbi? He had a number of individuals in the town who were not so pro him being the rabbi of the town, but ultimately they had took a vote in the town, and they all ultimately unanimously brought him in to be the rabbi of their community. And now we can say the rest was history, because this is when he became the rabbi of the town of Satmar, and that was ultimately what gave him his namesake to be the Satmar Rebbe. So in when he was here, so it was a very large Jewish city. The town that he was in was, I think, one of the largest Jewish communities in Hungary, Romania, at that point. He built a yeshiva there that had well over 200 students, and it very clearly became a real bastion of Hasidus. He was essentially building his own sect of Hasidus, and we'll see in just a moment, eventually he'll make his way to America, and so this was the real foundation that he had built when he was in this town. However, what's interesting is that he did not end up staying in this town for too much longer. As you can imagine, when World War II would come, he would have to leave there, but before we get there, in 1936, so his Rebbetzin Chava passed away, ultimately left the Rebbe open to wanting to remarry and potentially try to have an heir to his dynasty, as it were. But he will remarry, but he will not have another child. I don't know what to make of the story. It's just kind of a cool story, but all of the Satmar biographies seem to have it. So in source number 2, you'll notice there's a picture there. So there's the Satmar Rebbe, and he's shaking hands with a really, really fancy-looking guy. So that was King Carol II. He was the Romanian king of the time, and the way the story goes is that he came to visit the town of Satmar, and everyone came out, the Jews and the non-Jews. You know, the king comes to visit, so you go ahead and you greet the king. And the Satmar even made a bracha when he met him, as you would. You meet the ruler of your country, you would make a bracha, and he did. And what's interesting, though, is that the king went out of his way to greet the Rebbe. He saw all the people. He didn't have a meeting planned, but he scanned the crowd, and he went to shake the Rebbe's hand. Afterwards, the king was asked why it was that he went to shake the Rebbe's hand. He didn't even know who he was, which room to him. So he said, he scanned the whole crowd, and he looked around, and he said that it's clear that this man was a very holy individual. And it's interesting that the Satmar Rebbe was actually known for many things, but one thing in particular, that he had always had like this very angelic face, that he had this aura about him. I would say probably a God-given youth to his face, and just a general energy that people were very attracted to. And so that's what the king said, that he was sort of just drawn to him as a result of that. In 1937, so we're now about 2 years.
Please. King Carol was very good to the Jews. Those of you will have an opportunity to visit a place called Sinai in Romania and go skiing. Next door is a place called Pelage Palace. That's where, and there's all kinds of gifts from Israel and Jewish gifts in this palace. It's a wooden palace, it's not a stone palace over there. One of the things you'll notice in the picture is he's not wearing his hat. Traditionally, when Orthodox Jews were in Europe and they were in a government place, they took off their hat. That was a common trademark amongst things. The other thing is that I want to fill in, he did not call himself Satmar, because Satmar was St. Mary's. He thought it was a guy's name, and he called himself Satmar, is what he went by. He called himself Satmar. My grandfather was a Satmar Talmud and a classmate of Reb Yoash. So that's the way he referred to it. He did not like the word St. Mary. And there was one other town that he was popular in. If you ever go to Hungary, you go to Reb Shaya LeKeristir, next to the Ukrainian border, is a town called Ihel. I don't know. Ihel is crazy. It still has a minion over there. They're putting on towels and foam at 6 o'clock at night. I saw that myself with my own eyes. I've been there.
Thank you. Keep filling in. Sure. Yeah. Okay, so in 1937, the Rebbe would marry his second wife, Rebbetzin Alta Feiga Shapiro. It was noteworthy that she was much younger than Reb Yoash. I think he was 50, 51, and she was 25 at that point. And so the goal was to marry someone who was younger so that they would be able to have children. Again, unfortunately, that did not happen. But they would be happily married for many years. She would outlive the Satmar Rebbe, and she became known certainly later in life as a real powerhouse. We'll see that so many of the incredible things that we outwardly in the modern Orthodox community know about Satmar were actually more because of her in some instances than because of him, and we'll get to that in just a little bit. So in 1939, as the World War II began, so initially the Satmar Rebbe was very into the fact that he said, we're not leaving, we have to stay here. Unfortunately, what that ended up meaning was that a lot of the original Hasidim perished in the Holocaust. But he was very big into making sure that they would be sort of like this community that people could turn to, that when people were fleeing because of what was happening with the Nazis. And so he was very adamant that they would stay there and support whoever they could. The Rebbe Rebbe had to spend some time in a few ghettos before he would ultimately make it out of there. But in 1944, he did end up leaving because he just could not stay there anymore. The Rebbe ended up in Bergen-Belsen, the concentration camp. Interestingly, the Rebbe, Baruch Hashem, was not super impacted by the war in that he wasn't tortured in the same way as others, but nonetheless, it was obviously living in the barracks was you can imagine living in the barracks was. Interestingly, also, the Rebbe was not just taunted by the Nazis and those other terrible people, Yamach Shemam, but he was also unfortunately taunted by many of the secularists and the Zionist secular Jews who were there in the group. I don't think he was as well known for his anti-Zionist stance at this point, but just the secular Jews, they saw this man with a beard and they did not like him very much as a result of it, and so they kept taunting him. In fact, they even would tell him that the reason why the Nazis are torturing us so terribly is because you have your beard, Reb Yoel. And so they would taunt him to no end. And in fact, there is an amazing story in source number 3. Is this what I wanted?
That picture where he's covered up.
Yeah. All right, so we'll read this, but I want to say something else afterwards. So it says in source number 3, one of the most amazing manifestations of extraordinary heavenly intervention during the Rebbe's ordeal was that the Rebbe was the only known person to survive Nazi persecution with his beard unshorn and intact. Due to his impeccable cleanliness, even amid distorted surroundings, he somehow managed to delude the Nazis by constantly wearing a scarf around his face and beard, which made it seem as if he was nursing a bad toothache. Nevertheless, as a precaution, the Rebbe always had a hand-operated shearing machine handy in case it would become absolutely imperative to shave his beard off. Indeed, there were plenty of close calls, but whatever. So the Rebbe got to keep his beard, and obviously in Chassidus, certainly, that was something very significant that he never had to shave his beard off. But there were many of the individuals, the secular Jews that were in the group, who were so offended by the fact that he had a beard still and that he did not shave it off, that he had even offered on many occasions to just shave it off. It would make them truly happy, just to show, again, the Avas Yisrael, the love of every Jew that the Rebbe had, even with these Jews who were taunting him, he wanted to do what he could to make them happy. The Rebbe ultimately ended up forming tremendous relationships from, I think it was 5 months that he was in Bergen-Belsen. So from the five months that he was in the camp, he did make tremendous relationships. And if you take a look in source number 4, I believe it is, and it starts on page 9, but it goes to page 10, 11, 12, etc. But there's an amazing article that was written by a secular Jew who was with the Satmar Rebbe in the camps. And so we're just going to skip around a little bit. I highly recommend reading the full article, but it really, really is amazing. But if you look on page 10, the last, the third to last paragraph on the page, here's just one quote. He says, "I had never heard of a rabbi like him. The world of the Orthodox religious Jews was foreign to me, and I had never before heard of any Satmar rabbi. Therefore, it was no surprise that as a skeptic, I could not imagine how people could be so sure that because the rabbi was with us, we had every hope of surviving our hell. However, I later realized that our hopes were totally justified." And skip down to the last paragraph. "I lived with the Satmar Rebbe for 5 months in Men's Block E in Bergen-Belsen. I do not know how this happened, but it is a fact that Germans themselves permitted him to keep his beard, which the Rebbe concealed with a kerchief around his face, pretending to be suffering from a toothache. The Rebbe did not eat the camp food. He lived on water and cooked potatoes. As far as I know, he fasted 2 or 3 days a week. You could hear his voice in the barracks almost all day long. It was not talking we heard, but his prayers and studying. He had a mournful tune and sobbing gestures that kept many of us awake late into the night. I learned those gestures myself, and for years I could hear it in my head as a sad memento of those tragic times. The Rebbe's mournful tune made many of those living in the barracks nervous, but not me. I knew that the Rebbe was using that tune to pray to God for mercy. He fought against the decree and prayed for rescue." Right, so it's interesting. It sounds beautiful on the one hand, and of course it was very special. But on the other hand, you can imagine if you were a secular Jew and this rabbi was keeping you up late at night davening, you can imagine that there could have been at least some initial animosity. And so let's keep reading though. "The Satmar Rebbe was crystal clean, and even in the dirty barracks, dirt and vermin had no power over him. He used to lay on his bed, and his wife and his attendant, a young skinny man, devoted themselves to him, helping to have something to eat so he could continue with his religious activities. His majesty and wonderful appearance amazed everyone. I admit that I, too, was affected by his influence and appeal. There, among the barbed wire, the shadow of the angel of death was greatly weakened, and I began believing in heavenly forces. I often noticed that whenever Rabbi Teitelbaum recited his prayers, or whenever he simply sang his wordless tune, all of our eyes were filled with bloody tears. Okay, I don't really know what that means exactly, but that's what he says. On one summer day, I asked the rabbi's young attendant to obtain an autograph from the Rebbe, and the answer came quickly. The rabbi did not consider my request to be appropriate. The weeks passed, and the Sama Rebbe patiently and modestly suffered and got through the difficulties. However, I once saw him lose his patience. It was when on the Sabbath afternoon, when he was deep in study together with this individual, the Sama Rebbe's eyes sparkled, and the 90-year-old Rabbi Strasser yielded to the strong will of the Rebbe. And so, clearly, what it was that they were arguing over Torah. That's the idea. Anyways, it's an interesting article because it clearly shows that the Rebbe was amazingly able to keep totally connected, even in the horrible terrors of being in Bergen-Belsen. He was ultimately, of course, released from the camp, or rather, what's the word?
Liberated.
Yeah, thank you. He was liberated from the camp. So in 1944, at the age of 57, he was able to get out, and he made his way to Geneva for a short time. He was in Switzerland, and then he went to Israel, where he had always wanted to be. That's the big irony, that people call him such an anti-Zionist, but he had always wanted to live in Israel, and he indeed did live in Israel for I think it was about a year or so. He ended up then in 1946, when he was 59, coming to America for one reason and one reason only. He had started a yeshiva in Israel, and he wanted to raise funds for that yeshiva, but he had full intention of going back to Israel, where he really had wanted to settle. Again, unfortunately, that never happened, but for the first number of years when the Rebbe was here, so he would talk about the fact that he was going to be going back to Israel, so he would often express that he had no intention of settling down in America. Unfortunately, as we had said, so many of the Rebbe's followers had passed away during the war, but he did come to Williamsburg when he was in America, and he slowly began building the blocks and the foundation of what would become a tremendous sect of Hasidus. Naturally, because of his energy and his aura and his personality, there were many Hasidim who were who gravitated towards him. And eventually, once he did decide to settle in New York, he had already built up a significant following. Despite not being in Israel anymore, and obviously that was very difficult for the Rebbe would often talk about, or at least express on some level, the beauty of America and the fact that there was such religious freedom here. I mean, even the story of Satmar, as we'll say, which doesn't conclude, but towards the end of his life, it concludes with them picking up and moving to Kiryas Yael in Monroe. And so the fact that he was able to have essentially his own city in America, it spoke to the religious freedom that was here in America. If you take a look at source number 5, there's it's a cute story, page 14. One of the interesting things about the Satmar Rebbe was that in the early years when he was here in America, so there were very few Hasidim that would just walk the streets. It was not such a common thing in America. We know, right? We all seen like the non-Jewish reportings that, you know, they'll go to Williamsburg and they'll take like a picture of some of these Hasidim walking around. And so we say, I guess that's what it was always like, but it really was not like that. Most people did not wear a shtreimel in New York, but so take a look at source number 5 that sort of captures this. So he strode proudly down the street on Shabbos, his shtreimel firmly atop his head, oblivious to the stares and comments of those in the street. Occasionally, a secular Jew drove past in his car and hollered from the window, "Shame on you, is a desecration of Hashem's name." Such was the raw bias and hatred of our irreligious Jews, who are the worst in perpetuating the standard motto, "This is America." Fine. The Rebbe would not give in. Furthermore, he gently prodded his Hasidim to follow his lead. Yet even his closest Hasidim were reluctant to don a shtreimel on the street and, in their view, make a spectacle of themselves. One Shabbos, the Rebbe was walking accompanied by the Nanasha Rebbe, Rav Tzvi Avigdor Feketa, thank you, and the Gabbai, Rabbi Yosef Ashkenazi, who did not yet wear his shtreimel on the street. From the opposite side of the street, a group of young burly thugs, gesticulating towards them, burst out in vulgar laughter. The Rebbe paid them no attention. Rabbi Yosef Ashkenazi could not hold himself back, and he says, "The Rebbe saw that vulgar laughter. One cannot walk with a shtreimel in the street without provoking this type of a reaction." What did the Satmar Rebbe say? Immediately the Rebbe retorted with a serene smile on his face, "You really believe they were laughing at the two of us who do wear Shtreimlach? I would venture to say that they were laughing at you, because they see two Yidden wearing Shtreimlach and the third one is not." And so he said that, I don't know if he was being serious or not, but he sort of turned that around and again encouraged his Hasidim to be proud of the fact that they were Hasidim, and so he wanted him to wear the Shtreimlach as well. Okay, so... Yep.
The person of Yassel Ashkenazi was the attendant who stayed with him. His whole life he stayed with him. I also helped underwrite one of the Satmar Rebbe's Sefer. My grandfather was Rosh Mosda Satmar Yerushalayim, and he came here. When he came off the boat, he came here on Rosh Hashanah. Yes. He wouldn't get off the boat. He got off at night. People stayed on the Lower East Side, and then they had a discussion with my grandfather. They said, "It's a beast in this year, it's a wilderness here," and that's when they started the Beis Rivka Seminary. Ah. They were the ones who put together the money over there. Like that. My grandfather also did not wear a shtreimel.
Ever?
He was one of those people. He wore a hamburg, and I'm going to say it in front of everybody here. I say it about my grandparents. When you looked at my grandfather's shoes, it was literally like he was a meticulous, cleanly person. If we came in with dirty shoes, he would scream, "Charn to my grandma, Guy Kreitz and Nayashir, a Yiddish kin, Guy Nishay, but Jewish child doesn't walk around with dirty clothing."
Yeah, yeah.
That's the way.
But, yeah. That it seems like that was from the Satmar Rebbe's teachings. That he was very into this.
He was very into that.
Yeah.
His Rebbetzin was hellfire and brimstone. Loved Lois. One of these days, if you ever tackle us in the house, we have pictures of Lois sitting with Joseph in her lap and say, "He's so nice, he looks like a girl." You used to get nervous when he would say, "If Joseph is the doctor." Okay. And that's what she would say about him. But he had, the other thing I want to point out, he had a tremendous, tremendous sense of humor. One of the stories I remember, I'm sorry if I'm...
No, please.
My father was in the garbage can manufacturing business, was coming before Yom Tov. We would go for bracha, and I'll never forget, it was before Shana, and my father went for bracha for us. He said, "Maisha Dubin, Zerg Zechnish, in America, Siduasach Mis, Sitakaim Mishfeil Na Leiden," means in America, there's so much garbage, you'll never fail to have a living. All of you, 90% of you, if you had a medal, well, you're too young. Okay, who had a metal garbage can? It came from independent tinware. Came from my father. Unfortunately, my father was given the task to make the boxes to ship bodies to Israel. Too. Right. In the 60s, he was given that thing. His workers hated that job. We all hated that. We would have these metal boxes lined up in the shop. But that's.
Speaking about the Rebbe's sense of humor, there's another story that they say about him they once asked him. So one of the things that Satmar became known to, certainly in the outside world, was the chesed that they do, right? The Bikur Cholim that Satmar started, that his Rebbetzin started. And so one of the stories that they say is that they asked him, "So Rebbe, how come we don't make a bracha when we do Gnilas Chasadim? When we do acts of kindness, we should make a bracha like any other mitzvah." And so he said, "Here's the problem. Every single time you're going to have someone make a bracha, this is what the guy's going to do. He's going to go wash his hands because he wants to be in the right mindset. He's going to put a gartlach on and he's going to get so ready, and then he's going to be so exhausted by the time that he's going to do the act of kindness that he's going to say, 'I can't do the act of kindness because I'm so exhausted,' and he's going to want to go have lunch." And so therefore the Satmar Rebbe said, that's why we don't make a bracha on doing an act of kindness, again speaking to his witty sense of humor. Okay, so the Satmar Rebbe would begin really building up this group in Williamsburg, and he had he started a kehila there. It was like a four-story building, I believe. And he lived there, and he also had a base medrash and a shul there, etc. Interesting to note that at the beginning, when he was really setting the foundation there, they struggled to get a minyan in his minyan, which obviously that would eventually get a little bit better. But it is worthwhile to note. It was around this time that the Rebbe's wife also originally founded the Bikur Cholim, unfortunately, a few years after them being there, just shortly after, that's when the Rebbe's third daughter had passed away in 1953. She passed away in 1955. The Rebbe wanted to make sure that there was a way to continue to have authentic European Orthodox Judaism flourished, so he decided to found and really put together something called the Hisachdus HaRabbanim, which basically was a group of rabbis that would meet to ensure that that Orthodox standards were upheld. And so this was clearly not where our world was at this time, right? Rabbi Soloveitchik was not in this group per se. And so the goal of the group ultimately was to maintain the standards that they were all in favor of, which again was not what our communities were necessarily in favor of. Rav Moshe Feinstein, who obviously was a contemporary of all this, very famously had some tremendous disputes with the Satmar Rebbe. One of those disputes was the Mechitza controversy. The Satmar Rebbe and Satmar Chassidus in general believes that the Mechitza should be yay high, that you should not really see the other side at all. Rav Moshe Feinstein said, no, that's not true. It doesn't have to be. Rav Moshe had one of the smaller measurements, and he said, ultimately, at the end of the day, even if it's like shoulder height, that's certainly not a concern whatsoever. And so that was one of the big disputes between them. They had other major halachic disputes about artificial insemination. Could you allow artificial insemination? And like all these different disputes that would take place between the Satmar Rebbe and Rav Moshe Feinstein in that time. But then, of course, in 1960, that's when the Satmar Rebbe published his first volume of Vayoel Moshe. Vayoel Moshe is his big kuntres, his big sefer on why Zionism and why Israel is terrible. Again, not Israel chas v'shalom, but the state of Israel is so terrible. And I want to just delve into it just for a moment to help people understand. Again, this is a man who lived in Israel, had wanted to live in Israel. It was an anti, quote-unquote, Medina sentiment, which I don't think any of us here really subscribe to that, but it's worthwhile noting that one...
I have to tell you, and again, I got to fix that.
Yeah.
Because he believed in the Kedusha of Eretz Israel.
Yeah, Kedusha.
Do I believe, do I personally, remember, I'm a Satmar student. I was in yeshiva at 55. I was there in yeshiva. I was part of yeshiva for 4 or 5 years maybe. Okay. Did we believe that Ben-Gurion was a holy person?
No.
The answer is... Absolutely
100%.
Not. 100%. Absolutely not. And I still don't
subscribe. 100%. Right. It was people like to say that, or people mistakenly assume that the Satmar Rebbe was like anti-Israel. It's true. He's not anti-Israel. He was anti-Zionist. Different than the modern Orthodox theology, the Rav Kook theology, who put Herzl, you know, on a pedestal. But nonetheless, it was a Torah-based perspective. It wasn't like he just got up there and said, I don't like secular Jews. That was clearly not what was taking place. In fact, what people don't understand is that there was a real and critical sugya in the Torah that he based himself off of in terms of being anti-Medina that we should just be aware of. You know, sometimes people unintelligently like to say that, oh, I'm anti this person. Why? I don't know, because we're all anti this person. People don't realize what it's all based on. So just in a nutshell, not to go too deeply into it, because I do want to conclude in a few minutes, but basically, if you look at source number 6, this is a very famous Gemara in Maseches Ksubis on Daf Kuf Yud Aleph that talks about what's called the three Shavuos. That is that there were a few oaths that the Jewish people were said to have made with Hashem. And if you take a look, let's just read it in English over here. The Gemara, let's read it in Hebrew, actually. So, Ha'umi Ba'ale L'chad Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina Da'amar Shalosh Shavuos, that there were three oaths that the Jewish people had taken with God. Halalu Lama, what were they? Acha Shalosh Ya'alu Yisrael B'choma. The first one that will, and we'll just focus on this right now, is that the Jewish people evidently had made an oath with God. This is what the Gemara records for us, that the Jewish people made this oath with God, that they were not going to storm into the land of Israel, meaning they were not going to create a war of independence, as it were, and they were not going to attack the locals and the natives. They were allowed to trickle in, and that's how the redemption would come. But to come in and just create a whole war and create a Medina, that's something that the Gemara seems to be against. And so as a result of this, the Satmar Rebbe published the Sefer Vayoel Moshe. If you take a look at source number 7 on page 16, this is where it's hundreds of pages long, but in his introduction, he mentions it just briefly. He says, you want to know, I say this respectfully, try to realize that this is from a Torah point of view, so please, I know that not all of us agree with this, but it's important, again, to be knowledgeable of other opinions that are out there, even if we vehemently disagree. So he says as follows, if you take a look, in source number 16, we're in the right paragraph all the way at the bottom. So he says, V'achshav b'dorenu zeh, he says, why is it that the Jewish people have suffered so much in the 20th century? What was the cause of all the suffering? And I'm not even going to say the specifics, but we know what he's talking about, all the suffering that took place in the 20th century. He says, one does not need to look or search very far to find out where that the sin that has caused that suffering. Ki hu galoy mefurash b'divrei Chazal. All we have to do is look at the Gemara. And the Gemara will tell us why the Jews are suffering in the 20th century. Sheigidu lanu zos beferish shalamdu mikrai sha'al yadei ha'avira al hashvuos shalo la'alos b'choma v'shalo yidchaku asakeitz. He says, the sin is very simple. Why did the Jewish people get so horribly punished in the 20th century? Because the Jewish people violated one of the oaths that we took with Hashem, and that is the oath that not to break into the land of Israel with a war and with the real terror, but rather we should trickle in slowly. And so therefore, essentially, the Rebbe was saying over here, again, this is just the introduction of a several hundred page three-volume sefer, but he explains that the cause of all the terror that took place with the Jewish people is because of Zionism, and because of the fact that we as a Jewish nation, again, more of the secular side at the beginning, and then it became religious Zionism, but certainly at the beginning, because there was a secular Zionistic push to really push our way into the land of Israel, so that we can have a place for ourselves, so that we will not face persecution, and the Rebbe was very anti this. Again, to understand, this was a Torah perspective, and it is a Torah perspective based on real sources. We ourselves have to grapple with how do we deal with this, right? How do we deal with the fact that I think we appreciate and believe in the War of Independence, and that we believe in the Medina on whatever level we might believe in it. I think most of us do, at least on a base level, believe in the State of Israel. And so we have to grapple with this from a Torah point of view as well. Not for right now, but it is worthwhile to understand and just be wary of. Okay. So, ultimately, in 1968, unfortunately, the Satmar Rebbe would suffer a debilitating stroke that would ultimately lead to sort of like his decline and ultimate passing, but he wouldn't pass away for another 11 years. In 1975... the Rebbe had always dreamed of having a secluded area where the Hasidim could basically grow internally, as were. Right? So again, the Rebbe was very into helping the outside world with things like chesed and the like, but he also was very into this insular isolationist perspective of helping his chassidim grow, and that's where Kiryas Yael was born. And so there was a lot, obviously, as you can imagine, lots of legal fun that went into building this community. It's Kiryat Joel, is that what they say on the map? Kiryat Joel? They call it Kiryat?
No, it's...
What do they say?
What's Teitelbaum is a date tree.
Yeah.
It's the town of date tree.
Is it?
Yeah, because that's what they call Teitelbaum for... Remember, Joel's father-in-law, my son-in-law's father, is the original building department.
He still is
in charge of the building department, the fire department.
So, look, on the news, they say the town of Deep. They don't say that.
I believe it's Daytree, yeah.
All right, well, whatever it is, the Kiryas Yael is what they call it, what we call it. But that was in 1975 when that town was originally founded. The Rebbe did move there, but the Rebbe did pass away just a few years later. He passed away on August 19th of 1979 at the age of 92. Hundreds of thousands of people attended his funeral. It's worthwhile noting a few things, and with this we'll conclude. So first of all, people don't realize, we all know Chabad, obviously, we know different bells, different sects of Hasidus. There is no sect of Hasidus that is anywhere near as large as Satmar Hasidus. I think the numbers are in the hundreds of thousands of Satmar Hasidim which are around. So just the sheer number of them is quite amazing, and especially when you think of the fact how young Satmar Hasidus is. It's only in America, it's only, 60, 70 years old. So it's quite amazing how much has been built up. A lot of that is probably because of the fact that the Rebbe had such an isolationist perspective, and he wanted to be more insular, at least in terms of personal growth of the community. Following the Satmar Rebbe's passing, that's when all the fun really began, because there was no immediate successor. So the first thing that's interesting to note, and again, I think this speaks a lot to... I'll call it women's empowerment, but how strong his Rebbetzin was in the community. In fact, about a year after his passing, so his nephew, Rabbi Moshe Teitelbaum, was named his successor, but his Rebbetzin, meaning Rav Yoel's Rebbetzin, was such a strong personality, and she had, at least at various moments, thought that she would kind of be the one who would take over, that she ended up leading a small, do you know about this? Yeah, she ended up leading a small sect of Hasidim for a period of time. Ultimately, Similarly, Rabbi Moshe Teitelbaum had two sons. He had Rabbi Aaron Teitelbaum, or he probably had more than two sons. But
he had the main two sons.
Right, the main two sons were Rabbi Aaron Teitelbaum and Rabbi Zalman Teitelbaum. Each of them became a chief rabbi in different places. One was in Williamsburg, one was in Kiryas Yael, yeah. Yeah, okay. Good. And unfortunately, what basically took place is that after Rabbi Moshe Teitelbaum's passing, so his two sons had this dispute, and they split Satmar Chassidus into two, and one of them led one sect, and one of them led the other sect. Interesting to note that they did not speak for, I think, well over 20 years. And this is like contemporary time, like in the 2000s. They did not speak for over 20 years, but one of their wives, I can't remember which one of their wives got very sick during COVID, and I know this from the Wikipedia page. So I got sick during COVID, and the other brother called his brother to wish him well for like the high holidays
Baron's
and everything.
His wife was very sick.
Was she okay though?
She's okay.
But ultimately, it seems like they've reconnected and rekindled a little bit, just because again the pandemic messed all of us up. Even the more Hasidic crowds that were maybe back to normal earlier than us, they were clearly heavily affected, and they seem to have bonded over that. So ultimately, I'd like to conclude with just one or two final points. You learn about the life of the Satmar Rebbe, and again, this is not our world. He was a tremendous gadol, but it was not in our world, and so there's immediately, I think, a knee-jerk reaction to say, oh, what do I have to learn from this person? The reason why I wanted us to be aware of him and to give this breakfast and the base on him is because there are clear lessons to, obviously, hopefully you see a little bit, to learn from his life. First of all, just in terms of the sheer chesed that Satmar does and did do and does, and that was all because of his legacy that he left. All right, again, you can say whatever you want about Satmar, but at the end of the day, you go to any of the hospitals in New York City and you see the tremendous Bikur Cholim that they have there. That's all because of him, his family, his wife, and so that's something tremendous just to make note of. Anyone who has experienced that firsthand knows how tremendous it really is, and that was part of the Rebbe's teaching. Number two is just the Torah knowledge. Again, you could disagree with his Torah perspective, but nonetheless, he clearly had tremendous Torah knowledge and was critically involved in trying to make sure that the Torah legacy would live on, which obviously we can connect to as well. And the last thing I would say is that in terms of rabbis in the 20th century who were involved in ensuring that there would be a real religious Orthodox population that would live on, you can't look at what the Satmar Rebbe has accomplished to have over 100,000 Hasidim and realize how the impact that he has had in terms of the continuity of Orthodox Judaism. Because again, as much as we believe in modern Orthodoxy and whatever, there is some of it that unfortunately, but inevitably, becomes diluted. When you have, though, a very not diluted and a very sort of intense religious Judaism, such as Satmar Chassidus, and they have their own town, and it really is like this small little Satmarville. So what that does for the rest of the Orthodox Jewish population is that it sort of gives us that this is the highest standard and that they are living through and through an Orthodox Jewish lifestyle that we can't imagine when we're in the quote-unquote real world. And so as a result, I think that the lesson of realizing how much he has brought to the world, instead of looking at maybe some of the negatives that we do not appreciate, again, anti-Zionism and the like, to realize that he did do so much for the world, and he did a lot for Orthodox Judaism, and to realize that there is a tremendous amount to learn from that. I hope you all enjoy. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, I want to fill in two things. One of them, I had the opportunity to live through Lubavitch, and I remember I've been to Lubavitch literally maybe close to 1,000 times. We lived there. We davened there. We've seen the Rebbe every Shabbos before we davened next door to where he lived.
Okay.
I can tell you there were times these Rebbes did not have a minion on Shabbos.
Yeah.
Did not have a minion. The Lubavitch Rebbe, I was there by Mincha. They were struggling for a minion. One quick story with the Satmar Rebbe. A lady, a widow came to America lamenting. She lost everything in Nazi Germany, lost her husband, came with her son, and she was lamenting, she lost everything, her son became non-religious, and she said, why didn't I die in the Holocaust? So someone said, go see this refugee in Williamsburg. So they called Rabbi Yossi Ashkenazi, they made an appointment. She told him, it's not worth it, I want to die. She said, can you talk to my son? Very successful businessman. And he went along and he said, we can arrange that. So Yosef Ashkenazi calls, who was a personal friend of mine, calls this guy in for me. What does the Satmar Rebbe want from me? He wants to talk to you. And Satmar Rebbe comes in, and this story has been witnessed certified and bona fide. He goes, well, yes, when I was busy, business is wonderful. He said, terrific. I need a favor from you. I need you, my Hasidim can't get jobs where they don't have to work on Shabbos. Can you give a few of my Hasidim jobs? Of course I can do that. And he said, have a good day. 2 weeks later, he asked for his house and stole back from this one.
Wow.
But it's a witness story that this was, occurred. But that was his. He was one thing to one group of people, but to us, I walked around without pants. Yeah, she used to call me a kibbutz arete kravat. I always wore a red tie when I used to go see her. And this is even with Lois and the kids who were sitting around the house eating kokosh cake. We would go along. I always wore loud tie and loud shirt extensions. So don't think I didn't.
Scott, thank
but
you.
They were still very accepting of them. But my grandfather conspired. We never spoke English to any of us. But we all spoke. But he spoke beautiful English. Beautiful English. My grandfather came in 31 to 38, commuted from New York to America. He was a classmate. He was in the fur business, popcorn business. He exported popcorn from America to Munich.
Wow. Okay. Thank you for everything you added to this year. Thank you.
Thank you.